Welcome to the Modern Woodworkers Association, a podcast about woodworking from folk who woodwork. Woodworking is what we do, who we are, and what we like to talk about. So join us as we have a drink, sit around, and talk woodworking.
Hi, and welcome to the 323rd episode of the MWA podcast. I'm Kyle Barton. I'm here with my co-host, Sean Wisniewski, and our special co-host, Mark Hicks. And today, we're visiting with accomplished chair and furniture maker, Craig Becker. So, welcome to the show, Craig.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And welcome to be our special co-host, Mark.
Thanks. Thanks for having me back.
You bet, man.
Fantastic. And for those longtime listeners, you know, Diami is our third chair, but he's been very, very busy during these times with his business, and hope to have him back sometime in the new year. But until he gets back, Mark has kindly agreed to fill his semi-big shoes.
And it was, and Diami may take umbrage with that. He may be our first chair, as he was there before.
Well, that's true. Even, he could even be first chair. Yeah, but that would make his shoes bigger, so.
True.
No. I'm sure Diami listens to all our podcasts, so hats off, and we're thinking about you, Diami. So before we get started in talking with Craig, and for those of you that might not know Craig, he is Silent Mill on Instagram, so hopefully a lot of thoughts went off right there, so. Yeah, and Craig, I wouldn't know you were Craig Becker unless you hadn't ordered a couple of things from me.
Yeah, I think kind of a low profile on the social media, but yeah. Yeah,
well, not anymore, so there you go. All righty, Silent Mill equals Craig Becker. So anyway, but let's get into the woodworking news. So first off is a egg beater drill from Lee Valley. They occasionally make some replica, modern day incarnations of things, I guess, in their tool vault. And they recently did this with a very nicely, I guess, highlighted and engraved egg beater drill. And it's, you know, it's made for really, I don't know, small bits. I want to say it's probably on par with the Bridge City Toolworks little brace and bit.
Yeah, it's this one where, like, the egg beater, you know, it's got that gear going around, and that gear is slightly, there's a slight chance of the teeth of that gear biting the heel of your hand, because that's about all you can hold on to.
Exactly.
It's just, it's a little diminutive in its size.
Yeah, it's not your typical Miller Falls size egg beater drill. It's a little bit smaller. I think the maximum capacity of this is, like, 3/32 of an inch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah, 1/16 to 3/32. So that gives you
1/64. So it's got two columns.
Oh, okay, sorry. Oh, I see. Yeah.
1/64 to 3/32.
Oh wait, the two. Oh, it's because the two columns have those capacities.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just the smaller side of your drill case.
Yeah, but it is kind of cute. It is $76.50. So it's. I hope it runs as well as it looks. But knowing Lee Valley, it probably does.
I like the I like that real classic, like, open forged look to it. You know, it's just a there's really no handle to speak of other than the metal that it's in it.
Yep.
I wasn't joking about the teeth of that, you know, the gear, the part that you're spinning around. It's facing inward, and the picture they show, I mean, the heel of the hand is, like, right there.
There, yeah.
So
yeah.
you gotta be a little careful. And, you know, with a typical brace, you know, I'm used to leaning with the heel of my hand down on the brace. You know, I guess an egg beater drill is a little smaller anyway, but, like, even this, it looks like it has a, the little thumb thing on top, you could even put the heel of your hand on that if you wanted to, like, look down a little more and not have that pistol grip on it. But, for $76, I mean, you're going to want to really want it, I suppose.
I guess.
Perfect for, like, small hinge, you know, pilot holes and that kind of, obviously, we talked about small bits.
Well, I need to see if Kevin Almeida will buy this and compare it to the brace and bit that he got from Bridge City.
Yeah.
So shout out to Kevin. So
it's too funny. Yeah. You know, with Lee Valley doing their miniature, or I guess Veritas doing their miniature tools.
Yeah.
Their quarter scale stuff. That they haven't brought out an egg beater in that scale. This is like legitimately a replica of something that was actually in production at that size.
Yeah. And I do like the little engraving they did on the side of the wheel. Really cool. It's nice looking. It would be a sharp tool to have.
But... And put it on your Christmas list.
Speaking of Christmas lists, Lost Art Press is starting up their gift guide.
I saw that come over the emails today, today.
Yeah, so if anyone is familiar with Lost Art Press, every year Christopher Swores does a gift guide. And I don't know, usually it's about at least 5 to 8 blog posts, usually one every few days with gifts. And usually they're on the less expensive side for, folks that want to buy gifts for their woodworking friends or for family to buy gifts for their woodworking, relatives. So it's really usually pretty good. And I'm pretty stoked about the first entry because I got a little shout out.
Heck yeah, you did.
Yes. So the first entry is on the Star M's F-type drill bits, which I've been promoting for a few years. These are Star M is a company that makes, they're a Japanese company, but they make the wood owl bits. But over in Japan, they have a lot of different drill bits that they make. And one of these is called the F-type, and it has virtually zero tear out when you drill through it. And I don't know, I think it was Fine Woodworking Live a couple of years ago. I was like the drill bit ambassador because I discovered these things and I was like showing them to everybody. And I showed them to Chris and he looked at them and then I walked out. I met up with him a couple hours later and he said, I bought all of them. So, and with that, I didn't solicit any feedback from him, but I never heard back from him. But apparently, he is now recommending this as the first item on his gift guide. Are these drill bits? So I guess he liked them.
I think so.
Yeah. So anyway, but you can't get them in the U.S., but there is if you go to the blog post, he has a link to Workshop Heaven out of the UK, and they stock them there, and their shipping is really reasonable. And these drill bits are really inexpensive. I think they're in US dollars $5 to $8 a pop, so relatively inexpensive. And usually shipping when I bought them was like about $20. So if you buy a few of them, it's it's really not bad at all.
And that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
I know you've talked highly of them.
Long time listeners are probably going, okay, shut up about the F-type drill bits. One more time.
And it's something simple as I drilled two tiny little 3/32 holes into 1/4-inch plywood with standard twist bits and got blowout on the back end of it. Something that was a little cleaner would be nicer. In my capacity didn't matter, but. That's for definitely if you're in chair making, that's a 100% concern for you.
Yeah, but it's always nice, as I'm sure Mark can attest to get the stamp of approval from Chris.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, never hurts.
Never hurts. I did get a few extra followers today. So.
And Classic Hand Tools sold out of drill bits. So.
Yeah, oh, they did.
They got Schwarzed.
Oh man.
Yeah, I figured I was actually going to joke about that because I knew this was going to come up. Let's announce the Christmas list of things that you can't get because everyone else has already gotten them, because that's how it kind of goes every time Chris mentions something, is that it floods the market and people just go like crazy.
Yeah, that's interesting. The one drill bit on their site that they used to carry that they don't carry anymore, it's a 9.5 millimeter, which is like almost 3/8 inch drill bit. So anyway, there are places you can get them, but you got to search for them. I think I won't tell you how I got mine, but anyway, because that's not an option anymore. But
oh You sold, friend, you bought all of theirs.
A friend of the show, actually, who was stationed in Japan, sent me one. So, and a couple others that I couldn't get over here. But I think there's a couple of places in Australia you can find the 9.5 millimeter. And who knows, with hopefully with the increase in demand, that they'll start stocking that 9.5 millimeter again. But anyway, let's move on to what's in the shop. So, Sean, what are you working on?
I didn't get any work done over the weekend, but I did wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning to run a half marathon before driving 3 hours away with my son and successfully completing NAR level 1 rocket certification. Now, that is not woodworking related in the slightest, but that's what I did.
Well, congratulations to both of you. So,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so the early running was a function of just schedules being mucked up. Mm-hmm. This was actually 2020 being what it is. This was the first actual in-person race that I was signed up for. And I so much as picked up my packet to do the event that my son informed me that not only did we have to go 3 hours away, but we had to leave at 6 o'clock in the morning to get there on time for the team that he was part of. And I was going there too, but it was really more for him. And I said, well, screw it. I'll just run by myself in the morning to do this virtually, because that was still an option.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I had a very chilly morning run, which is weird to do all alone.
Yeah, I was about to ask you. So I assume that this was like a run that you're not running with anybody. You just kind of document, hey, I did it.
Yeah, first. Kind of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm that kind of guy that will just wake up at the ass crack of dawn and run 13 miles. Yeah,
that's not ass crack of dawn. That's dark 30 right there.
It's dark 30. It is. And literally, my wife said the night before, she said, careful of people. People are just leaving the bars. Like, you're kind of right.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like that's it was. And I honestly, though, I mean, we live in a fairly quiet area, and so I don't think I counted more than 5 or 6 cars that I saw the whole time. I was out for a little under an hour, 40 minutes, and just it
now,
was.
Did you have a beer when you finished?
I thought about it, but I didn't.
Man.
I got home. Did I shower? I think I showered, and then I was on the road within 35 minutes to drive to what is the very, very southwestern portion of Michigan, in a town called Michiana, because it's apparently Michigan and Indiana couldn't decide on a good name for the town, so they combined it.
Cool. And then your son got the level 1 rocket.
No, I did, actually.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's mine. Right. You were doing
that. My big yellow rocket.
Yeah. So this has nothing to do with your son.
I got to fly that. Right, so he got his level 1 last year. That's what kind of got me going down this path.
Okay.
But I got to sit at a launch and do some things I've never done before, which is kind of crazy, and so see some things I've never done before.
Cool. So what is level 1 for?
So level 1 is the first level of high power. It is the first section out of what you can buy generally from like a hobby store. Mm-hmm. That's kind of advanced since we were kids. There's a little more in there, but it's all measured by how much force that you can have in your for propellant, right?
Okay.
So you can do some minor damage with the biggest motors that you can get from the Estes kits that you can buy at the hobby store. I bought a motor at this event. I couldn't even buy one beforehand. It's because it's like literally federally regulated.
Wow.
Because now I'm in a capacity where I can now purchase and handle propellants up to 640 newtons of force, which is a lot of power. They're not volatile, but they can produce high thrust in that way. Mm-hmm. And so they can be, you know, you can cause damage.
Yeah.
And so now in my basement, I actually have two such motors that fit into that capacity. They're in cardboard tubes, and they're like, you know, don't open until you're going to use them kind of situations. But that's level 1. And then as you go, it just kind of multiplies with complexity and danger all along the way.
Okay.
But it was pretty uneventful. It was very much like putting up a rocket like you do when you're a kid. It was just large. It was almost 6 feet tall, 4 inches in diameter, and it only went 700 some feet in the air and came down soft. So kind of what I wanted to do is certify, because it was like, I purposely built it in a way and picked a motor that would not thrust it super fast. It would just lift it up and let it come down. And that was, if that's now I can kind of experiment and try new things. So it's just kind of the stepping off point. Well, but cool. A big deal. I mean, I told some kids, like, what's that for? I said, oh, I'm just the same as the high school kids that are doing the same thing, but I'm just an old guy. I mean, I built this thing almost a year ago, and I haven't had a chance to do it. So I finally got to do it.
Well, pretty neat. Everyone should stay tuned for the Modern Rocketry Association podcast.
I will say that's already been taken. You can find find a couple different shows on the podcatcher of your choice.
Oh, I'm sure you can.
Yeah.
Sure you can.
I can make it about woodworking and not rocketry, possibly. Maybe. Except for all the fiberglass that I have now, because I've already got some fiberglass kits that I'm gonna build up. That's a little different.
Yes. Just
a little stronger. A little less pervious to water and bad weather.
Yeah. Well,
but anyway, how about more woodworking related things, Kyle? What are you doing?
Not too terribly much. I'm doing a lot of stuff that I can't announce really yet regarding my K Barton tools and maybe some new things coming to that endeavor, new products, but not ready for prime time just yet. But besides that, I've just been milling up cypress for the Adirondack chair. I think I've talked about on a couple of podcasts. So I'm milling. So
milling.
Yeah. So I don't know if I explained this before, but if I did, it was a few episodes ago and everyone's forgotten it by now. but this Adirondack chair is basically a copy of one a friend of mine's father, who passed away recently, built. And it's only all the members of it are only 5/8 of an inch thick, which most Adirondack chairs are a little bit thicker in some areas, a little bit thinner in other areas. But I mean, this thing's held up for 25 years, but it was made out of redwood and they wanted an exact copy out of redwood. And so I called up my local lumber dealer and said, hey, what do you got for redwood? And yeah, I called him back and said, how about cypress? And they said, okay, we can do cypress. I went, okay. So bought a bunch of cypress. So that's what I'm milling up for it. But yeah, redwood was outrageously expensive, I guess, with the pandemic and everything going on. I think those prices have dramatically increased.
Well, the fires didn't threaten the redwoods, did they?
Could be. I don't know.
I've never
really seen that do it. But the other thing that my lumber dealer had is all they had was clear too, completely clear redwood. So I'm sure that added some cost to it also. But that's all I've been doing. So Mark, what have you been doing?
Well, Monday I shipped my most recent workbench to Minnesota. So, or I guess it was Tuesday. I don't know. It's on its way. It's on its way to Minnesota. So
it's on a
happy
truck
customer
right now
to be there.
Yeah.
We tried to go on Saturday to buy lumber for the top of my son's desk, but they didn't have any cherry, but they're bringing some in for us to come and look at this weekend. So,
oh, cool.
We're pretty excited about that. And I got that crate out the door and I looked around and realized like my shop is a disaster and it's time to clean. So I spent a little time off and on today cleaning the shop and it looks better already.
Oh, good.
That's
good. It's going to be interesting when you post the pictures of your clean shop versus your dirty shop and how many comments you get.
I think what's clean to me will still be dirty to everybody else.
Oh, okay.
Oh, there you go. Is it always a good feeling when you get another bench?
Oh yeah, definitely. It's.
I mean, not just for the sale that you made, but.
No, it's a relief. If there's one thing that makes me anxious, it's people waiting on me.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I can't like write a check in a grocery store. I like having people standing behind me in line just drives me nuts. And this particular bench, this customer was really patient. I was building a a shave horse and filming the entire process for mm-hmm. folks who buy the kits. And that just, you know, being only able to work a couple hours a day, that just really took a lot longer than I was expecting. And so he just sat there and waited patiently, and now he's got his bench. So, or he will.
Cool. Yeah. What's the old adage that, you know, filming will automatically double the time that it takes to make something?
Yeah, I've heard triple.
Maybe triple. Okay.
Yeah, I would say triple. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really hard to tell because I'm not working in full days. You know, it's like I go out and film for 20 minutes, and then I have to go back in and check on the student. And so, yeah, it was, you know, it was a lot of new things to learn at once. So,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I got more comfortable with it.
Sean, to your point, I think it's like double actually doing the work, but then you got to edit it.
Okay. I get that.
Yeah. At least that's my experience.
For radio. I don't do that video crap.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I shouldn't either, but I do.
No,
occasionally.
You do fine.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Thank you. $20 is in the mail. All righty. So tell me about building those crates for the benches. So is it just a 3/4 inch plywood, 1/2 inch plywood, or CDX or something like that?
Yeah, it's 7/16 OSB.
Okay.
And then I use rippers from the workbenches for all the blocking and stuff. So.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
You know, I rip a bunch of 2.5 inch squares for the corners, for the bottom, and some 5/8 thick strips to go underneath them. And then I use 1x1 maple in the corners where all the boards come together to have something to screw into. I used to drop some pieces of 1 inch thick foam in between the bench and this OSB to mm-hmm. fill that space. I never really liked that because it's styrofoam. And I've recently started putting a few extra strips of maple in there, and then I double wrap them with that 1/4 inch thick, you know, really like flexible wrapping foam.
Oh yeah, yeah, I know what you're talking
and
about.
And that gives it enough spring to keep it tight and in away from the walls. And that I want to have a 1 inch air gap all the way around the bench. So when somebody drives a forklift into the side of the crate, if they've got a split second to stop before they actually damage the stuff mm-hmm. inside. And that's worked out okay so far. Usually the damage is underneath the crate. They'll ram into the blocking underneath the crate.
Yeah.
And knock off a base or something like that. But we've had, you know, so far so good. We'll see if that holds up. But whenever I design a crate, my first assumption is the people working in the shipping department are trying to destroy it. So how can I keep that from happening? And that's not fair to them, but it's a good mindset to have. They are not trying to destroy it, but, you know, it is a rough place inside of a shipping warehouse. So accidents will happen if you assume the worst, you'll have a better crate for it.
How long did it take for you to figure that out?
I knew right away.
I
shipped a bicycle to myself when I went to college my freshman year, and they absolutely destroyed it. Like it took, and I never got a dime. They were like, no, we're not paying your claim. So, I lost a bike to a giant shipping company. And I said, okay, well, I had a bad taste for shipping after that, but I've gotten over that. Now I just, you know, I'm better prepared to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree. Yeah, even my little jigs, I'm sure people that receive them go, so what costs more, the jigs or all this bubble wrap?
You know, you put a lot of time and energy into it, and it would be a shame for it to get there and be damaged.
Exactly.
You know, you could spend an extra dollar on packaging and save yourself a lot of trouble on the other end. So
yeah,
it's worth the time.
So do you have I assume the shipping company comes to your shop. So, do you have a forklift to load it on, or do they have one on the truck, or what?
They can't get to my house. Actually take it to the depot, but yes, I do. When you asked about my favorite tool, it was a toss up between my little walkie forklift and my bandsaw. I discovered a few years ago that my back was broken, and the debate began whether we would buy a tractor with forks or we would buy a small forklift. And the forklift won because it takes up much less space and is a lot less expensive. So
interesting.
Yeah.
That's cool. Cool. Yeah. So Craig, what are you working on?
Yep. So I'm finishing up my Dutch tool chest, which seems like it's taking a heck of a lot longer than I wanted it to. I'm about to, I think I'm finishing up just the final touches on the top compartment and just getting that all Tetris in there with my hand tools. And after that, it'll be a coat of black paint. And I'm debating on whether or not to put the forbidden drawer in the next compartment lower underneath the top compartment, but we'll see. It'll probably be something that I tackle at a later date.
Well, that's cool. Yeah, I've been following along, and it looks absolutely fantastic, all you've done. And I liked the little I was late to the poll, I guess, on what you were actually making with the little brass knobs. That was pretty cool. The little brass, they look like pulls, but they weren't pulls, but basically to hold your little mallet, your brass mallet. So
yeah,
that was pretty cool.
I actually got I got into turning a lot of those things with the I did a post a while ago about the spoke shave little rack that I did, and I'm probably going to be moving that over to this shop here in the near future. But the new carbide turning tools, they're excellent for turning non-ferrous metals and things like that. It's been playing around with that a lot lately, messing it up a lot and having to start over. But yeah, it's a interesting and fun process. You just got to go a little bit slower, but yeah, it seems like it's working out pretty well.
Well, cool. So you actually turn that on your wood turning lathe. You don't have a machinist lathe.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yep. I just take a little bit slower speed and again, I use files and just like base metal files primarily, and to just kind of establish the initial profile. And then I'll clean it up with the carbide inserts, turning tools. And it seems to be working out pretty well. I've, you know, tried some quarter inch stuff, and it's amazing how metal behaves so much. It's a lot friendlier than wood most of the time. So
Cool. Well, let's move on into, and I want to find out all about your new shop, because I know you just moved into a new shop, but before we get there, so why don't you tell us a little bit about, you know, your background and how you got into woodworking?
So I think I have a pretty similar story to most people. I, you know, in my young adulthood, I started having to buy furniture and hated every single piece of furniture that I purchased. the furniture that you can buy at stores or, you know, the big box stores, it's just garbage. It's not made well. It's not made to be moved around from place to place, and it falls apart. So I started tinkering around with making pretty much everything. I think I started with a bookcase and then just moved forward from there. And everything I made was absolutely terrible. But it was still better than what I could buy. In terms of, you know, construction from a design aspect or aesthetic, absolutely horrible. I'm sure most of it made its way to the wood pile to be burnt at some stage. But yeah, and then I pretty much worked for years just trying stuff out, making every mistake you could possibly make from construction to design and buying tools that I didn't need and kind of doing it the hard way. I learned a lot, you know, kind of through the long road and taking the long way around, and kind of got to where I am now. And just being here in New England, it's, you know, it's the mecca of traditional furniture craftsmanship. There's schools everywhere, there's people teaching it everywhere, and I was fortunate enough to be located right next to North Bennett Street School. And, I, yeah, so I, I didn't take the traditional route where I did the 2-year program or even the 3-month intensive program. I kind of cobbled my way through formalizing some of my training with their CE program, continuing education programs, which are excellent because it's kind of an a la carte approach to, to you know, you kind of get to pick and choose what you want to learn. And for everybody who's listening, that is 100% the way to go when it comes to, you know, if rather than trying to figure it out on your own, if you can just, if you're anywhere in the country, just taking a little bit of time and money and just spend it on getting some formalized training in any area that you're, you know, you're working on or trying to improve upon. And it pays so many dividends in the long run, rather than you end up saving so much money and so much time and pain and suffering as a result of it. So I did that, at North Bennett. I took a class with, the father of chair making, Pete Galbert. Was kind of off to the races from there. I did a little bit of design instruction, formalized design instruction at Massachusetts Mass Art, so the art school here, and that's kind of where I'm at up to present day.
Cool. So when you were at North, or taking the classes there at North Bennett, was that in their new facility or their previous facility or both?
No, it's in their new facility.
Okay.
Yeah, which is great. This is all prior to the COVID strike of 2020, of course. But yeah, it's cool.
So you took the class with Pete, and I know you do some commission work on various kinds, but most I see you posting is about chairs. So is that primarily your interest there?
Yeah, I really like making chairs because it is a complex piece of furniture that what I love about it is it's at certain points in the construction process, you have to be extremely precise. And at other phases, you can be a complete knucklehead and you can just kind of wing it and it all ends up working out. And
yeah,
it's super rewarding when you get a piece that comes together and you can start kind of, once you do it a few times, you can kind of start venturing out into your own style, and that that's another layer of motivation and reward to be able to feel like you've made something that you've made a piece of furniture that people are going to have to interface with to use. You know, it's different than a case piece that just kind of sits in a corner and every once in a while you'll open a drawer or a door or something like that. Somebody has to sit in your chair and they will tell you what it feels like almost every single time when they first sit in it, you know? So it's a cool thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what I like about chairs too. It's fascinating. And so and you took your first chair class with Pete, so that had to be fantastic. That's kind of how I got into it. I took
not a bad place to start.
Yeah.
I took a class from Pete, and I think it was with him and Charlie Ryland was helping him teach the class. And between them yelling slice and skew, the other thing they would yell was, "It's just a chair."
Yep. And when we were on the shave horses, he would yell at us to row. Yeah, all the time. Yeah. Yeah, he's a great teacher. He was very, very forgiving. And I don't know if I took his class for the same reasons that some other people take his class. I wanted to learn the process of constructing a chair and then be able to apply my own design aesthetic to that process. And that, you know, so it was more, I remember sitting down the first day of his class and I pulled out a notebook and he was like, "Yeah, you got to put that away, dude. Like, you're not going to have any time to do that."
Yeah. I got a book right here.
Yeah. Go buy the book.
Yes. Yeah. He told me you got to buy the book. And I wasn't the typical guy going into Pete's class. I didn't know Pete and I didn't know, you know, what he was about or how accomplished he was or what type of person he is. And I was like, oh, here's this guy trying to sell me something else. You know, like I just paid you all this money for this class and now you're trying to sell me your book, you know? So I kind of, had an interesting, initial interaction, at the class, but it's absolutely necessary. That class, taught me that class. I felt like I got more of my money's worth out of that 8 days with him than any other class that I've ever taken. And I was tired at the end of every single day. And I learned more about, wood movement and wood as a construction material. And it broadened my understanding of furniture construction, in general, and then brought in another whole aspect of green woodworking and what is this? And like, how do you manage, pieces with different moisture content, and how does a mortise fit with a tenon and with two different moisture contents, and what do I got to pay attention to here and there? And it was fascinating. So I was off to the races after that class, and I couldn't get enough of it.
Oh, that is so cool. Yeah. When I took the class with Pete, it was the first class sent as he was publishing his book. So before the class, Lost Art Press published it, but it wasn't available except on a PDF. So I'm like scanning the PDF like days before the class. And then when we get to the class, Pete has like the proof copy, which is unbound, sitting there. So he's like, okay, this is the first class I've taught with the book being published. So he's like going back and forth. Oh, look at this. All right, look at this. So it was pretty cool. But tell us a little bit about some more of your other commission work. So besides chairs, what have you done?
So I do, I primarily like to play around with, I guess for lack of a better term, we can call it the thicks and thins of different traditional pieces of furniture. So I kind of, I tend towards the shaker style, and we'll add some Windsor elements here and there, with stuff. I have, a couple of commissions coming up. One is for a poster bed, a four poster bed or a canopy bed for a child. Just a lot of the settees that I've done, I've tried to mess around with some of those, profiles and different design aesthetics to bring a more modern, touch to the chairs. And, and that helps with.
Well, you're just leading me on because I wanted to get that out of the way before I started talking about your settee. So. I'm really enamored with what you've done with your settees because it does have a little bit of shaker, a little bit of modern, and I love. For folks that are listening, go to Silent Mill on Instagram and just scroll through his post. But. Yeah, I love that settee where it's just got that one long stretcher in the back. That is just fantastic.
Yeah, big, bold crest rail.
Yeah.
Tall crest rail, yeah.
Yeah, thanks. It's all a derivation from the shaker style. I mean, what I like about their stuff is it's simple and it speaks volumes in its simplicity. And when you find that when you kind of reach that realization, or at least for me, it almost brings your work to a higher level. And it's counterintuitive because you would think I got to build this crazy complex piece in order for people to understand how skilled I am at woodworking. Some of these simple pieces that are very easy to construct, they're very difficult to make because you got to pay attention to like a little bit of tear out or something that doesn't quite match symmetrically when it needs to be symmetrically. It stands out like a sore thumb, and then you got big problems on your hands, and you may end up having to remake these pieces that when somebody looks at it, you're like, that can't be that hard, but it's tough. And then having it, go together and look kind of correct as a whole piece is really challenging when the piece doesn't have a lot of, decorative elements or different, you know, grains and, you know, really ornate kind of pieces that are hanging off of it.
Yeah. And I really like what you did. The spindles in the back crest and the legs are all painted black. And then you left the seat natural, but under the seat, it's red, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I just, that's
like, you know, only the gerbils and mice are going to see that, but it's fantastic.
I find myself kind of doing something like that, whether I make a post about it or not. Most of my pieces have something, you know, that only the most intimate of user will discover. And most of the time I don't say anything about it. They'll find it eventually. So it is something to do on a piece that doesn't, like I said, doesn't have a lot of ooh and ah kind of stuff going on with it. But, you know, it's a nice conversation starter when, you know, you can bring a guest into your house and say, oh, hey, come over here and look at this. This is something that not everybody, you know, gets to see. And it screams custom when, mm-hmm. when, you know, somebody takes a look at it. So.
So is the seat on this saddled?
No, not at all. That one's dead flat. There was one, I believe, in the, you know, if you scroll down a little bit more on Instagram, I put up that is saddled, and it's saddled in the center. So the actual front edge and the rear deck actually is on the same plane. So
yeah, that's what I was wondering. Yeah, because I saw that one and this newer one didn't look like it was saddled. So I was just curious. So cool.
Yep. And that the not saddling a seat, I played around with you know, I fought with myself over keeping it flat like that or actually carving it. And I actually wish I ended up carving it because it was so much harder to leave it completely flat and then fight with the tear out or the potential for tear out, you know, drilling the legs from the underside and everything else. So I ended up kind of taking it took a little bit more time keeping it flat and then having to pay really, really close attention and go extra slow when those legs were getting mortised.
Yeah, cool.
Kyle has some bits he'd like to tell you about.
Yes, I do.
So. Good luck finding them, but
yeah. Thanks, Chris. Yeah.
Maybe by the time those next commissions start, you'll be able to get them.
Exactly.
Yeah. If you need some, you know, just hit me up. I got a special.
Or premium.
It's just a small administrative charge. Okay.
Can I ask about you did a chair for, I guess it was the American Handcrafted.
Yep.
You know, and I, there's one of those little details that you were talking about where you, the outer spindles and the center spindle, you brought them through the bottom of the seat.
Yep.
I thought that was a really elegant little detail. I wanted to give you kudos for that. But I wanted to know, you know, how did you get involved with American Handcraft and what is the story behind that chair?
Yeah, so actually Frank was and still is an instructor at Mass Art, and he taught me. There's a design class that I took with him, and it's also kind of like a drawing class as well. So he was my drawing teacher, and he's American Handcraft on Instagram, and he does large restaurant kind of installations or facades for commercial, you know, businesses and different things like that around Boston. And he's a fabricator. So he will tell you that he's not much of a furniture maker. But he has a great eye for design and has a very modern touch, to his process and does excellent work. So, I've always been into charity, and I've kind of been kicking around ideas on how to do more of it. But I kind of hit him up off the cuff after I finished this class and made a chair and wanted to do something, you know, for someone or hopefully, raffle it off for a charity. And he's going to add his flair to it. And we're going to auction it off, or it's going to be auctioned off here pretty soon. But yeah, so it worked really well because I make very simple things, and which leaves kind of a blank canvas for a guy like Frank to flare it up if he sees fit. So it's good. Yeah.
You have any idea who it's going to benefit?
We haven't decided on the charity yet. It definitely is going to happen. It's going to be something local here in Boston, I would assume. And from my talkings with Frank, it's going to be, he's going to add a, I don't want to say decoupage kind of look to it, but he's going to add a little bit more of a advanced decoupage kind of fabric application to the wood, to where it forms in with the carved seat and maybe drapes down part of the leg or something like that. So, and then the rest will get painted black with milk paint. So we'll see how that ends up.
Look forward to seeing that.
Yeah, it'll be flashy for sure.
No kidding. Wow, that's great. Well, let's move on to tell us a little bit about a product you're promoting, your lathe finger savers, as I'm calling them. I don't know what you want to call them, but you sent me a sample of those before the podcast. I guess they're Dermastack is the trade name. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it's a company that I owned that we developed this. It's basically an anti-friction, anti-abrasion patch or pad.
Mm-hmm.
It adheres to your skin, and it was developed for athletes and primarily CrossFit athletes. So it's
okay.
The adhesive is very, very strong. It is designed to stick under the worst conditions, you know, for mm-hmm. athletes who are sweating and moving and doing their workouts and exercises. And it's what makes it unique is the heat adhesive and the fact that the patch, after you peel the paper off, it stretches bidirectionally. So it will stretch in its length and its width. So it pretty much will not, you don't have that typical, failure that you see from a Band-Aid, you know, like on a joint or something that you're having to
right.
move a bunch. So what I've done with them is I wrap them around my fingers when I spindle turn. I put them in between my fingers when I'm using a draw knife. If I have a cut on my hand, I will put a Band-Aid on, and then I will put one of these Dermastack patches over the top of it, and it protects. It flexes so much with your hand, and the Band-Aid underneath it, or the bandage underneath it, won't come off. So it's it allows me, when I'm turning, it allows me to support the spindle or the leg with my off hand. And you know, most people, they turn, if they're running askew down a spindle, right. they'll turn at a slower speed, and that can introduce some. It can help when you first start turning, but when you get proficient at using a skew or using a gouge, you want to turn the speed up. But you know, when you're supporting that thin spindle or the thinner side of part of a chair, it starts to flex and you'll end up having issues with friction and burning your fingers. So if you wrap one of these patches around your finger and in the spot that you need to support that piece with, you can crank the speed up, which facilitates your ability to run the skew across it or a spindle gouge across it in a more efficient manner, mm-hmm. which is excellent. It does wonders for that sort of thing. And really the sky's the limit with the patches. I just recently started sending them out to woodworkers all over the place and have received nothing but positive feedback about it. Yeah. And to tell the truth, I don't know why I didn't think of it earlier, but yeah, I have. Yeah, no, they're great.
They work incredibly well because I was like, okay, so you sent those to me. So, you know, I went down and chucked up some maple and it did exactly what you're talking about, the skew. And I took the skew to it, and I did it without the patch on there. And, yeah, fingers get hot within, I don't know, 15 seconds or so. And yep. then you start, you know, just barely touching it, you know, just to get it through. And I put those on and did the same operation. And, yeah, it was much better. Didn't have any problems with my fingers heating up and got a much better finish off the skew because of that. So.
Oh, that's wild.
And it guys like, yeah. Natural tendency for people that don't have that solution is to put a glove on, and guys don't do that. That's
no,
like
yeah, no, I was gonna say no, like no. So it doesn't have the risk of being pulled like a glove might to get wrapped around. It holds that tightly to your skin that it's just an extra protective surface.
Absolutely, and they stick really well to themselves too. So they I have them in three separate sizes, so small, medium, and large, and they're just different lengths, basically, of the same patch. And if you need to wrap it a couple of times around an index finger or a thumb, or even pull it down in between, you know, the webbing of your fingers, it'll stick, and that'll stick to your skin, it'll stick to itself, and it really does wonders for your ability to, you know, kind of resist that friction and the failure of your body's skin, and you won't have to put a glove on, which is super, super dangerous.
And I found I could even cut them up and make little bitty patches to just, you know, put on like a fingertip.
Hot spots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I used those on my hike a couple weeks ago.
Yes. On my heel. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. The athletes, you know, we tested them doing that kind of stuff too. They're great for guys doing deadlifts, you know, running a bar up and down their shins. They do wonders for that sort of thing. And that's what they were developed for. So, there, you know, anything that anybody's going to put them through in a wood shop is a heck of a lot less intense than, you know, somebody going through a workout. So yeah.
Yeah, Mark, I'm used to using like moleskin, you know, for blister protection, right?
I did moleskin with duct tape over the top.
Oh, dang.
It worked wonders. It was excellent. Yeah. New boots, so no problem.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, because I've seen people, you know, wrap their fingers in that, I don't know what it's called. It may be moleskin, but that gauze type stuff.
That's like grip tape or hockey.
Yeah, but it's like it's a medical tape that they use to do bandages that'll stick to itself. But even doing that, I mean, it's real thin, so you really got to wrap it. This stuff is fairly thick. I mean, it's probably, I don't know,
it's a couple
30 second or something like that thick.
Yeah, it's I can't remember the exact thickness of it, but it's definitely it's a little bit thicker than a chunk of duct tape would be.
Yeah,
I would say, and it's got a cloth, you know, top to it.
Yes,
so
exactly.
The adhesive runs the entire, you know, front to back, left to right of the patch, and it's not like a Band-Aid. So you can utilize, like Kyle said, you could cut it up and you can utilize all the way out to the very edge of it, and it's got enough of a an anti-abrasive kind of top to it that will stand up to you beating the heck out of it.
So where can folks get this if they're interested in it?
So right now, they can just DM me. I'm going to probably end up doing a post on Instagram about it. And I have a website that I'm, you know, doing for my furniture right now. And I'll also make those available on that as well. So
yeah, if you're DMing him, that's Silent Mill on Instagram. So.
Yep, and the domain is not anything crazy. It's just silentmill.com.
Okay, fantastic.
Well, hats off to getting exactly the same thing. That's pretty awesome.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, the domain was acquired first.
Yeah. Well, you do have one of the all-time great logos I've seen in some time, and I do cherish your sticker that you sent me a few months back. So.
Yeah, that was a couple of beers into a night on Adobe Illustrator. Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, since we're here with Mark Hicks, why don't you tell us about your new bench?
Oh yeah, it's like talking boxing with Tyson. I'll make an attempt, but hopefully I don't embarrass myself.
I think it looks beautiful. I like it.
Yeah. Thanks. High praise coming from Mark. So it's just I would assume it's a Rubo style.
It's like my Dutch tool chest, which is a mini Dutch tool chest. It's not the small, it's a mini. You got like the mini Rubo.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted a bench that I could get a settee up on top of and I could get around easily. I have at my home shop, I have a La Chapelle bench that's European beach. It's an antique and it's like an aircraft carrier. And I hate it because I have to walk around it and I just fill it full of crap. So, I wanted something that was a little bit, little smaller on top, but also had the mass in the base to be able to stand on its own and not have to be bolted to the floor or anything crazy like that. And I only really went off of like two measurements with the entire thing and then took every other piece was kind of fit off of the existing pieces. So I stuck with like, I think it's 30 inches on a stretcher on the front stretcher and bench height is like 35 inches and everything after that. If people have asked me how big it is and I have to actually put a measuring tape on it to tell them. So, cause I don't really know. So, I don't know if that's the way Mark does his benches, probably not, but this one was just for me, so I got to just be kind of an idiot with it.
I don't measure anymore. I just have a story pole, and so I just, you know, I look for the little marks and transfer them onto the boards.
There you go.
Well, I tell you, that bottom shelf is something else. You have that all fitted in there.
Yeah, I actually, that was an afterthought. I was going to, kind of like the forbidden drawer on my Dutch tool chest. I'm putting that bottom shelf in eventually. And I had the opportunity to travel up to the hardwood supplier that's in New Hampshire. And I just went ahead and picked up the hard maple while I was up there and just did it really quick. So, yeah.
Well, it's much nicer and prettier than my shelf, which took me like 10 years to actually put in my bench. And when I did, it was just like a piece of like 3/8 inch plywood screwed down.
Yeah, there you go.
Stretchers.
Yeah,
took like 20 minutes. Done.
The my shop mates here, they're I've received mixed reviews. All of them say it's wonderful, and some of them are like, I wouldn't work off of that bench if you paid me to work.
Is it just because it's a little shiny?
Well, yeah. Well, that and it's like it's nice. I don't know. I subscribe to the philosophy. If I'm going to take the time to make something, I'm going to make it nice. So even if I'm going to beat the crap out of it. But
now, what is the finish on the bench?
So the finish is Osmo wood wax. And that in it of itself is not durable enough to withstand what you're going to do to it. So,
but it shouldn't impede anything though.
Either. No, it definitely doesn't. It's the colored wood wax, the white colored wood wax. And then on top of that, I have, the Varathane, finishing wax that just comes in the can. And I just periodically wax it. And it's wonderful. That finish, once it's dried and buffed out, I can do glue ups right on top of the bench and the glue just chips right off and it doesn't stick to anything. It's great. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you like the H&T Gordon stuff, our Vice Hardware?
It's like jewelry. It performs amazingly well. And, I love it cause it's super low profile. I don't have, like, I, I'm sure we'll get to this, you know, my new shop, but I work in a very, very small space. And I had to make something that had a really small footprint. I didn't want a huge end vise hanging off, adding length to my bench. And it just wasn't going to be practical for me. It probably works for other people, but for my application, it wasn't gonna work. And I didn't really have the time to apply all of that additional stuff. I needed stuff that was gonna take a beating and be able to be installed very quickly and not take up a lot of space. So this fit the bill in every capacity.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that their standard? I'm talking about the face vise. Is that their standard vise, or is that the articulating one?
No, this is their standard one. They do sell, Heartwood Tools does sell the little pivot that you can kind of drill. I think it's like a half inch hole in it, and it's got the little pivot guy in there. Mm-hmm. To handle that stuff. And on my Christmas list this year is their pattern maker's vise. And if I'm lucky enough to have people that care about me enough to buy me that, that would be wonderful.
There's a GoFundMe page.
Yeah, exactly. I got a mortgage on my home, you know, to get that. But yeah, I'll probably plant one of those guys one of these days on the opposite corner of the bench and use that for, you know, the crazy curvy kind of stuff. But yeah. Mm-hmm.
Cool. And the I guess the wagon vise works well.
Yeah, the so that the little guy, this is the smaller version. They come in two lengths. You are talking about the one off the end vise, right?
With right,
the,
right,
the
yeah.
knobby guy on the end. Yeah. So yeah. This is the shorter one. I think this is the 11-inch one. And again, I got the smaller one because I have a smaller surface on my bench. It comes in the a 14 inch, and that has a little bit longer travel for some of the bigger benches, and you can space out your dog holes a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's wonderful. It opens and closes very quickly, and it holds really well. What I do like about it, and I haven't used it, for this yet, but it comes with the different heights of dogs, so you can actually plane like really super super thin stuff if you need to.
Oh, okay.
All the way down to like I think Terry on YouTube does veneers like 3/16 or something like that with the holding it in the end vise, which is crazy. So yeah, you can do all kinds of stuff with everything that I would ever need to do with it. It definitely is gonna fit the bill for sure.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, and then you've also built a shave horse I want to talk about.
Mm-hmm. A Mark Hicks.
Hicks version. Yeah, I think so. I think so. Because I think he had a comment on your post about your seat there. So
yeah, he did. Yeah. That was back when I was like, oh my God, Mark Hicks saw my shave horse and he liked it. You know, that brand new thing. Yeah.
And now you realize it's really just not that big a deal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was I built a couple of shave horses actually that were terrible, absolutely terrible. But what's great about people always say when you build a shave horse, your first shave horse, you're going to end up putting it in the wood pile, and that's going to inform it's going to inform everything that you need to know about building your next shave horse, which will probably be your final shave horse. And it definitely did that. You know, I built a really crappy shave horse, that I spent a lot of time being frustrated with. I got hit in the chest multiple times with spindles and all different things because the head let go on me and I broke a couple of heads on it, like just straight split them in half. I tend to be heavy footed on my shave horses and beat on them. And then I found the plate 11 bracket setup and kind of built I bought the plans from Mark and built the shave horse around that. So yeah, I still have it, still works fine, wonderfully. And hopefully it'll be my last shave horse I ever have to build.
how you want to do it.
That's how you want to do it. Exactly. Exactly.
What I like to hear.
Exactly.
Unless you need to build a second one, and then, you know.
But yeah. Yeah. That's
right. I like that even better.
Yeah. And then I know a guy.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, in case he doesn't have time to build a second, you might like that even better.
Yeah.
Mark will do that for you too.
So tell us a little bit about how you build your chairs and other furniture and moving into the new shop. So are you primarily a hand tool guy, a hybrid? What would you classify yourself as?
I would say, when I was in between shops, I was a hand tool guy. And I'm sure that I gathered a significant number of my followers during that period, because I have managed to drop some followers as a result of me moving to a more hybrid style of woodworking.
So, I have a planer now.
Yeah, exactly. Like a number 7 is beautiful to, you know, take pictures of those ribbon shavings, but using a number 7 for several hours to flatten something is miserable. So, and especially if you're trying to make money at doing it, it just takes too damn long. So there's no, you know, it's great. What I do is I use the machines and I get it close, and I'll take those nice fine shavings to get it perfect with the hand tools. And that always works. You know, that's the way to go if you're working on a commission or you're doing batch work where you got a bunch of pieces to make. So that's the ideal method. Otherwise, I'm a hand tool guy. I like hand tools. I enjoy using them, just not every single time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So tell us about your new shop. So tell us about where you were working and what you've moved to.
Yeah, so I was working out of basically the equivalent of a single car garage. I had one 110 outlet that I was off of. So it was almost exclusively hand tools. I have my Nova lathe and my Nova drill press at home. And
Do you have the Nova drill press with the, you know, like all
the automatic nice backup and all?
Yeah, I have all things. That. Yep.
Oh man, I love that.
Yeah, it's great. The only thing that I will tell potential purchasers of that drill press is that it's only as, just like anything else, it's only as good as its crappiest component. And the crappiest component on that thing, which is more than passable for most, is the actual chuck. So you have a hyper, hyper precise, ultra smooth drill press, and they put a garbage chuck on it. So spring for the, you know, just budget in the extra $200 and get yourself a nice Austrian or German made precision drill chuck. And that thing has absolutely no run out and it will go up to 5,000 RPMs as smooth as glass. You never need to run it that high, but you know, when you first buy it, you got to take it all the way up to the top to see what it does. But yeah, it's a great machine. Never need to use any drill stops ever, because I can look at the digital readout and I can drill a hole to a certain depth and know, okay, if it's 0.750, I know that I just need to drill to 0.750 on every single one of my successive holes, and they're all perfect. So, it's a big time saver, and it's a great drill press. I highly doubt I use it to its fullest capacity. There's menus upon menus of things that it does. So it's cool.
Well, that's great. I've looked at that thing forever, and it looks like a fantastic drill press. But that's great to know that. Hey, budget in getting a quality chuck to go with it. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So tell us about the new shop.
Yeah. So I don't know how I stumbled into this opportunity, but there's a shop space in Boston, in Charlestown, called and I have not mentioned this on Instagram anywhere, because it's so recent, but it's called Charlestown Furniture Makers. It's a shop that's kind of a collective of 19 crafts people. There's some very accomplished woodworkers here. And I am the new guy. So I got into the shop and they had an opening, and I pinch myself every time I walk in the door. There's a machine space downstairs that has everything here is on steroids. So there's a 24-inch joiner. There's a 12-inch joiner. There's, wow, you know, like helical heads, and there's a, oh, you know,
that a Tanowitz crosscut saw. My God.
Monstrous stuff.
I love that thing.
Yeah, that thing creates its own weather. It's amazing. So, the shaper, sliding felder, you know, table saw that you can, rip cut an entire sheet of plywood remotely, you know, just ridiculous stuff. And then there's upstairs, there's bench spaces, and it's all kind of divided into, we each have our own individual section. And I think my bench space is a total, it's the new guy bench space. So, it's a total of like 80 square feet, and that probably blows people's minds. But with the massive machine space downstairs, I only have enough room up here for a bench, a Dutch tool chest, a mechanics cabinet, and some Festool arts. And it's more than enough space for me to get done what I need to get done. And every day I get to kind of come to work with people that are way better woodworkers than I am. So it's a wonderful opportunity just to learn, if not by watching, you know, just like if I ever have a problem, I can, there's a number of people that I can just say, hey, what do you think about this? And I think I'm one of the only guys that's not a North Bennett Street graduate of the two-year program. And I say guys, I mean guys and gals, because there are several very accomplished females that work here. And they've been excellent ever since I got here. Since day one, they welcomed me with open arms, and you know, everybody's a fan of everybody else's work, and we all kind of push each other. So it's wonderful.
Yeah. Well, you listed in our show notes some of your shop mates, so why don't you rattle them off?
So,
I know one of those you need to stay away from, but go ahead.
Eve Radovsky works right next to me. She's a North Bennett grad. She's on Instagram. Yeah. Judy McKee, she's got work in the Louvre. She is not on Instagram, and she has hashtags that are devoted to her. she's like a level of if you can reach that level, let me know how you did it. But because that's it's
wow.
Wow.
And then there's Donna Nigerian. She does Judy McKee's casework. So and she's also a North Bennett grad, and she's a wonderful person and woodworker, all on her own, very accomplished, all on her own. But she is she helps Judy do the basically generate the case pieces, and then Judy will do the carving and the different ornate kind of sections of her pieces before they're either sold or put into museums. And then there's
You're accomplished when you got someone that does the casework.
Someone is
really, really good. Yeah, exactly.
It's all like, by yourself. Yeah.
It's like, holy crap. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll tell you this. It's one thing to be able to take a couple of photos of something and put them on Instagram and have people ooh and ah over that. But it's a totally separate thing to walk up to a piece of furniture and just be absolutely floored by how beautiful it is and how perfect the craftsmanship is. And some of that stuff is hanging around right now. I'm sitting in the shop right now, and there's some just jaw dropping stuff that comes, you know, that people work on, and it's a circus here. So, Brennan Simpson, he's on Instagram. He's a North Bennett grad. He does some pretty awesome work. He works right across from me, space right across from me. We have like, some dueling chair situations going on most of the time. Yeah, Grant Berger, Billy Locke, they do a lot of work together. Billy's not on Instagram. Grant definitely is. He does the
Stay away from Grant. Yeah, at least for the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, COVID Grant.
COVID Grant.
Yeah, he said to say hello to everybody. But yeah, he's great. He does the Dusty Life podcast with Kyle Toth. And then Bob Miller is shop manager. Uncle Bob keeps us all straight and makes sure that we don't go Lord of the Flies in this place.
So he helps maintain all the machinery downstairs and all that kind of stuff.
He does. He's the guy that makes sure that we don't do anything too crazy, and when we do, he fixes it. He's the guy that must have been asleep at the wheel and let me get a shot at this place. So I've been tippy-toeing around here, making sure I don't break anything for the time being until I get a little bit of seniority.
Oh, well, fantastic.
It sounds like a great environment.
Hell yes.
Yeah, extremely great environment. I'm sure you're just inspired all day long. But I want to say, I bet some of your shop mates are inspired by what you're building too. So don't sell yourself short.
Yeah, I'd like to think so. It's a great environment here. Like you said, it's one of those places that it's everything that you probably think it is and more. It's really pretty exceptional.
Well, cool. Well, so what's next for you?
I think I'm going to probably take the shotgun approach at it just do a little bit of everything because diversification is kind of the only free lunch you get in the world. I definitely want to push the Dermastack patches and commercialize those and get those out to more woodworkers. I'm pursuing some avenues of approach right now for that. I definitely need to flesh out the website a little bit more. I want to add a blog and I'm hoping to cover and kind of find an outlet via that website to help woodworkers out with maybe a little bit more in-depth documentation of some of the stuff that I did, you know, the bench and mm-hmm. Dutch tool chest, things like that. And then the store, the online store, I'll implement that here pretty soon, and custom furniture commissions, you know, things like that. I definitely like to move from more of a word of mouth commission source to reach a broader, you know, kind of audience and hopefully accomplish that out of Charlestown Furniture Makers and via my website. I don't know if many people know this, but I love making tools, and I kind of dabble in that from time to time here and there.
Be careful on that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know, Kyle. I know all your warnings about that. Yeah.
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 So start making tools. You don't make anything else but tools.
Yeah, it's a slippery slope, but I really enjoy. I really found a lot of enjoyment in helping people. Through Instagram, people asking questions. I love the questions. I love to answer the questions. Spend a lot of time in the comments on my Instagram whenever I can. A tool is a way to perpetually help somebody. You know. Absolutely.
That's a great way of thinking about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, you had me made that super shorty stretcher base. And I was just like, okay, all right. And what was so funny is you emailed me about that. Hey, could I get something that could only be a couple inches off the base of the seat? And I was like, you know, I've been thinking about just making something that was a continuous taper. I think that would work for that. So
I did that. I did the same thing to Bob Miller. Bob Miller runs the Mass Woodworks, and he makes all the swanky marking gauges. And I just bought one of those from him. And I chair makers need marking gauges that use pencils, and he uses, you know, all of his marking gauges have the knife,
right,
which is perfect for joinery. And I'm standing there staring at this beautiful marking gauge with a drill in my hand, and I don't want to drill a hole through the marking gauge to stick a pencil in there. So he's going to be working on doing a pencil version of his marking gauge, hopefully, all because of my persnickety request about not wanting to drill through his marking gauge.
That is so funny. Yeah. Because woodpeckers a few months ago came out with this real short marking gauge. Mm-hmm. And they'd had it before. It's one of their one-time tools. And they had it before. And I missed it before. And then they re-released it. And I remember a couple of reviews on it was saying, well, you know, this concentric tip leaves a real rough thing. And I'm going, oh, that's perfect for spindles. And then it had a little insert where you could insert a pencil into it also.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah. And I went, oh, yeah, I'm buying that. And I did. Yeah. And it works perfect for spindles. It is fantastic. But, yeah, I like all the negative reviews where it goes, it leaves too rough of a mark. And I'm going, that's exactly what I want.
The only one you can see in freshly split oak. And
exactly.
Exactly.
So, but... well, with that, let's move on to our fortnightly beer choices. So I'll start it out with, I'm still drinking the You'll Shoot Your Eye Out by Carbach here in Houston, Texas. It's a fantastic beer, and hey, I bought a case of it, so I'm still drinking it.
That's it. Marching through that, man.
So, Sean, what are you drinking?
So I picked up a local brewery. Doubt it's distributed very far. Ernest Brew Works here in Northwest Ohio. They're New Serenity. So I'm in Northwest Ohio, and I'm drinking their West Coast IPA.
Of course, you know.
As you do.
They should have like a Mid-Coast IPA, do they?
No, I don't know what that would be.
Something like that.
I guess, you know what? I don't actually know the characterization of an East Coast versus West Coast IPA. To say what would be the middle, you know, is it astringent? Is it piney? Is it? I don't know. I mean, and in the hops that they could put in there, not my business. So maybe there's somewhere there's a Midwest IPA that we
I'm
could
sure
just
there
call
is.
A blend of the two or unique to our own. Who knows? But no, it's a good one. It's just I think you got to be in Northwest Ohio to get it. So good luck, Mark. How about you?
I am sipping on a glass of Law's Whiskey House 4-grain straight bourbon.
Wow.
Okay.
Oh.
And they are, I discovered them when I was at a Lee Nielsen hand tool event in Denver, Colorado. And I was lucky enough to have a student who had some friends coming out, and he gifted me this bottle at the end of the class. And it's been sitting in the shop waiting to be drunk, so I've decided to open it tonight and have a glass.
That's why you asked to join us tonight. I get it.
I needed an excuse to drink in the middle of the week.
Oh man, that sounds fantastic.
It's good.
Yeah, I just got hip to a couple of weeks ago about a bourbon, which is called JTS Brown Bourbon, and apparently you can only get it in Kentucky. But it's made by the same distillery that does the Elijah Craig bourbons. And apparently it's supposed to hold its own with almost anything, but you can only get it in Kentucky.
Well, next time I'm in Kentucky, I'll have to get a bottle.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. The same thing.
I collect bottles of bourbon like I collect tools. You know, you can't have too many.
But they were saying, you know, it's like, you know, 750... a bottle of this is like, you know, 17, 18 bucks, but it will hang with stuff that's like 300, 400 bucks.
That's what you like to hear.
Yeah.
Worth trying. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just like, oh, well, how do I get this? And yes, it's only available in Kentucky. You know, it's just like, okay, can I get anybody to ship it to me? No, I can't get anybody to ship it to me. Damn it. But anyway, so so Craig, what are you drinking?
I am drinking a Virginia craft. It's called Lickinhole Creek Craft Brewery Farm Brewery 3-chopped Triple Ale.
Wow!
Mm-hmm. Wow!
Yeah, it's the creek has the worst name. I'm this is a family show, so I won't repeat it. But But yeah, yeah. It's let's see. The Three Chop name comes from a nearby colonial era trail marked by three hatchet marks on a tree. And it says it's a non-stop hopped version of a European classic. And it's good. It's good stuff. Heavy.
Well, it sounds nice.
Yeah.
So Craig, I meant to ask you earlier. So are you from the Boston area?
Yeah, I was born in Lynn, which is they call it Lynn, the city of sin. So yeah, it's not a nice area. But I grew up here in the Northeast and have traveled kind of up and down the Eastern Seaboard throughout my years.
I was just wondering, you don't have a typical Boston accent, at least to my ears.
Oh no, definitely not. I lost that at a fairly young age.
Well, with that, so Craig, where can folks find you on the interwebs?
Yeah, so they can find me on Instagram at silent.mill, and they can also find me at silentmill.com.
Fantastic. And Mark, what about you?
I'm on Instagram at markbuildsit and plate11.com, as well as plate11 woodworking on YouTube.
And Sean, what about yourself?
I'm SeanW78 on most everything. How about you, Kyle?
You can always find me at Barton.Kyle on Instagram, the only social media platform that matters. And with that just about wraps it up for this show. So if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on the podcatcher of your choice. Just search for the Modern Woodworkers Association. And while you're there, please leave us a review.
Thanks for listening. You can follow us on Instagram at MWA_podcast. The best thing you can do, though, is tell a friend. Word of mouth goes a long way in sharing our discussion.